This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Escape the heat to True North convenience stores and get any size True Oasis fountain drink for 89 cents with True Rewards. Cool that thirst with any of your favorite Pepsi fountain drinks for 89 cents. As a free True Rewards member, pick the perfect size for you. No matter if you're craving a big drink or a small sip, it's just 89 cents. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
I started to record games on VHS tapes. Not with the thought of going back and doing play-by-play for them, but I wanted to go back and watch the games. And eventually I realized, okay, what would happen if I grabbed a tape recorder and started announcing those games, even though I knew the results and all that stuff? And I didn't have any notes. I would just take the recorder and just announce.
And our guest this week is Derek Jones, one of the great play-by-play voices locally. He does work for ESPN. He is the voice of Princeton men's basketball. He used to do Princeton women's basketball. Also teaches at Rowan and is the station manager for the student station there down at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey. And Derek, thanks so much for coming in.
Matt, always good to see you. Thanks for having me.
So we are recording this end of July, and we were kind of talking on our way up here. Kind of the quietest time of year for you, a chance to recharge?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, this is kind of the downtime, the down season for me. I've had a chance to do some cool things. I got a chance to go to Dodger Stadium for the first time a few weeks ago, which was really neat. So I'm just enjoying the quiet before the storm and the fall rolls around.
Now, you did some college baseball stuff this year, right?
Yes, I did. I did some games for the SEC and their baseball rundown, and it was great. ESPN does a tremendous job of covering college baseball, and SEC play is a part of what I do. So I did some games during the regular season, and I got a chance to cover the Oxford Regional, which was tremendous. Murray State ended up winning the Oxford Regional. They beat Ole Miss incredibly twice, beat Georgia Tech. And then eventually, later on down the line, made it to Omaha in the College World Series. So that was a great experience. I've told people, if you think SEC fandom is serious only for basketball and football, you need to go to SEC baseball games. Those fans are no joke. That was an electric atmosphere down at Swayze Field in Oxford.
So when you're doing something where you're covering multiple teams like that, how do you approach prep when there's so many rosters, so many stats, stuff like that?
There are a lot of research devices that are at your disposal, some that ESPN gives you, obviously, that you can work with. You can go back and review previous games, previous at-bats, previous pitchers from players, things like that. So you can kind of go through and get ready that way. But I think also, too, you have to pretty much attack teams on a day-by-day basis as much as you can. You don't have a lot of run-up time for regionals. You know, we found out where we were going Monday when the field was announced, and then the games start Friday. So you really have only a couple days to kind of lock in. So I've always approached, okay, who do I know the least about? And kind of attack it from there. So obviously, you spend a lot of time on Murray State and Western Kentucky, and then Georgia Tech I had a little knowledge of because I've done a little ACC stuff, but Ole Miss I'd already seen during the course of the year. I'd seen them just a few weeks ago prior to the Oxford Regional. So you spend a good chunk of that time. If there is a team that you know, you just refine on them and then focus on the other teams. The key to me with those kind of events is making sure you get there beforehand and talk to the players, talk to the coaches. We had a chance to get there the day before, and they had all day practice sessions for teams, and we got a chance to connect with the coaches for all of those teams, which is an invaluable experience. So I think that's such an important aspect of it, being able to talk to them, because they help color in a lot of the stories that you need for a broadcast about teams. Because you have to remember, too, the fans watching these games in the NCAA tournament, many of them have not watched all year or have just watched their team. So you're trying to fill in the blanks for everybody.
I want to talk more about the way you approach broadcasting, but first let's get into your backstory. Now, reading up on you, it sounds like play-by-play was the plan since you were like 12, 13, that this was what you wanted to do, right?
Yes, yes. I had the good fortune of growing up in the Philadelphia area, and growing up, Harry Callis was calling Phillies games. He was doing stuff nationally for the NFL on radio. He was also narrating inside the NFL and a lot of the NFL film stuff. Gene Hart for the Flyers, and of course, Merrill Reese for the Eagles. Like, those are the big three guys that I listened to a lot growing up as a kid. And you, of course you would, because you're a Philadelphia sports fan. So you root for all four teams. You know, Jim Barniak was doing the Sixers on TV for Prism. So Andy Musser as well, who was doing some Sixers stuff, and of course Philly stuff. So all of those guys kind of made it fun to listen to the games, to watch the games. And then around that time, I started to become a fan of the NFL. And, you know, the Eagles were really good, and they're in the NFC East with the Giants and Washington and all these great teams. And you'd hear Pat Summerall and John Madden a lot, and they made every game feel special. And I was like, man, I think I would like to do this. And then when I was around that age, I started to record games on VHS tapes. Not with the thought of going back and doing play-by-play for them, but I wanted to go back and watch the games if I had some downtime to watch them. And eventually I realized, okay, what would happen if I grabbed a tape recorder and started announcing those games, even though I knew the results and all that stuff? And I didn't have any notes. I would just take the recorder and just announce. So that's kind of how it all started for me.
When did you start to realize you were pretty good at it? Was there a moment?
No, I've always been my toughest critic. I don't think you have people who say, hey, you're doing okay with this. You're doing well with it. And I would listen to that and I'd say, okay, I guess I should keep going. I think I had people who encouraged me a lot when I first started. Frank Hogan, who was the general manager at Rowan Radio at the time when I was a student broadcaster there, was a big encouraging factor for me. John Sadak, who is the play-by-play announcer for the Reds, he was the sports director when I came in as a student at Rowan Radio. So that was really intimidating because I considered him a friend, but John was serious business when he got in the booth. So you didn't want to let him down. But he said to me a lot, he was like, hey, I really think you could do this if you stick with it. So I would listen certainly to those people. I would try to get advice from folks. And you know, I wrote broadcasters. I remember writing Gil Santos, who was a longtime announcer for the Patriots on radio, and he wrote me back some stuff about football and how to cover games. So I just stuck with it. And then I think with Princeton, when I was covering women's basketball, you know, Coach Banghart would say, hey, you do a really nice job for us. And then I would hear from the parents. They'd say, hey, you do a really nice job for us. We really appreciate it. So that it was kind of a snowball effect, I think, where I kind of over time just got confidence with being able to do it, because originally I was just doing radio. I had no designs on really doing television. So when I was first doing radio, I was like, okay, I think I can stick with this and we'll see where it goes.
All those names you mentioned, is there someone, even if it's subconsciously, you kind of look back and you ended up patterning the way you broadcast a game after them? Or is it little pieces? Or do you really feel like it's kind of mainly you?
I think it's mainly me, but I think there's some concepts that I have kind of clipped from people. I think Merrill Reese, when the game is building to a crescendo, I've always thought he was really good at kind of building the drama when you're listening on radio. So I kind of grab a little bit from him. I think one of the things that I try to grab from announcers as a whole is the feeling that this is important, or telling people why a game is important. I think sometimes that gets lost. It's easy to tell everybody why this playoff game is important. It's easy to tell everybody why the first game of the year is important. What about the 10th game of the year or the 18th game of the year? How can you convince people that these games are important? I think those announcers always did a great job of that. And I think also, too, even though those announcers, the Philadelphia ones locally, were representing Philadelphia, I always thought they would find ways to tell you if things weren't going well in their own way without making it like hot take-ish kind of stuff. So I always appreciated that and always try to take that out of the pool as well.
Do you remember the first game you did?
Ooh, it was – remember the first basketball game I did? It was Rowan in the Checkers Classic. I can't remember who they played, but it was on radio and I was yikes, I was scared. That was the first basketball game I did. I had done college football for Rowan my freshman year, and I believe they were playing New Jersey City University. I'd love to be able to – I have it written down somewhere. But one of the tricks with those games, the first year I was doing it as a freshman for RTN, you could only do a half of a game. So you would do one half play-by-play, and then the other half you'd go on top of the press box and shoot the game. So I want to say it was Rowan NJCU. I've blocked a lot of my early college memories out of my mind because I'm like, I don't even want to listen to these tapes. So I remember bits and pieces of some of the early days, but it wasn't until I think my junior year in college where I was like, okay, I feel comfortable now. We're ready to roll. John put me in the booth with him and Jason Helder to call Rowan football. So that was a huge confidence boost for me, and they ended up going to the national championship game that year, so that was pretty cool.
So what's the door opening? Obviously, you're getting all this experience at Rowan. You know, once you kind of graduate, how do you go about getting your foot indoors to do it at places like Princeton, eventually ESPN?
It was a pretty unique experience because one of the things I think sometimes people forget is, you know, this stuff is seasonal. You have to find ways to pay the bills. And so right around the time I graduated, Frank Hogan had come to me and said, hey, I think we're going to have a graduate assistantship program lined up here. We've had one lined up here for students who are interested in getting a master's degree. So, you know, think about that. Stay an extra year. You could do some games. And luckily, I was able to be sports director the second year. So I stayed for that extra year to get my master's degree. So at the tail end of that, he had an opening for an assistant station manager position. It was a newly created position, so I ended up getting that job. As a result of that, it did two things for me. One, it gave me more opportunities to call games because we were understaffed back then in the sports department. So he said, look, you can help call games. You can help with production stuff. So I was able to do that, and I've still wanted to pursue other things, so I was able to do that. Now, around I guess maybe 2 or 3 years into the job, John Sadak had gone on to start doing Princeton women's basketball. On occasion, he had some things that he was doing in terms of other broadcasting opportunities that popped up, so I would fill in for him. So that's how I kind of got my foot in the door at Princeton. So I ended up filling in occasionally and doing some of the women's basketball play-by-play. I did color with John on the Ivy League before they did the Ivy League tournament. They had a 1 year in, I believe it was 2006, the 05-06 season. They had the three-way playoff, and they had to – Princeton was a part of that. They ended up losing, but I was a part of the coverage for that. So that was my foot in the door, and then eventually John went on to start doing Princeton men's basketball, and I got connected to do women's basketball full-time.
I'm curious for my own edification because – there are times in the year we're just following you on social media and talking to you when I see you at Penn Princeton games where you are everywhere. How'd the opportunity with ESPN to do stuff for them come about?
I have to credit my good buddy Noah Savage, who I do games with at Princeton. So Noah at the time was looking to get more opportunities. So he was working on his demo and he was sending it out, and he sent it to some folks at ESPN, and they got back to Noah and said, hey, we think you're really good. We'd like to offer you some games. By the way, who is the play-by-play announcer with you? We'd like to talk to him too. And so Noah called me, and that's the thing. You know, he could have just said, nah, now let's stay out of this one. I'll handle it. He called me right away and said, hey, David Seisler wants to talk to you about potentially doing some games. Just be ready for that. Lo and behold, David Seisler reached out to me about possibly doing some games. We had been in contact after Noah made the original connection. And so that's how it happened. I mean, it is weird. I don't, because one thing I had been really bad at is, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, putting myself out there, I was just like, man, I don't know. I don't know if I'm good enough to do this on a bigger scale than what I'm doing it at right now. So he kind of pushed me out there one way or the other. I think one of the big things that happened around that time, too, was the league was starting to take off, the Ivy League. So because of that, I would say those two things were really two big factors in how I ended up with ESPN. The Noah thing was huge, but also the fact that the league was ascending, they got a deal with ESPN. So we were starting to do our games on that platform so I could get TV tape, what amounted to TV tape, and send it to them and share it with them. And that was a huge help for me. So that's how I got kind of into the ESPN side of things. And, you know, eventually down the line, I got involved with baseball. I've dabbled a little bit with college football, but it's been a lot of fun.
For people who aren't familiar, break down how you approach doing a Princeton game. And I don't mean the broadcast itself, but a team that you're the guy.
Right.
You are there, you know, for the grind, as opposed to doing a game where, you know, you just head off to Hartford for an overnight and you're doing a couple of teams that you have no connection with. Right. And, you know, break down how you approach those two separate types of broadcasts.
I think for the Princeton side of it, it's I've always looked at it this way, and I've tried to explain this to students. As great of a character as Rocky Balboa was, Rocky's not quite as cool if he doesn't have an enemy to deal with. So Clubber Lang, Ivan Drago, I want to focus on the opponent. And I spent a lot of time focusing on the opponent. Obviously, once you – in the beginning of the year now, it's a little different. In the beginning of the year, you're trying to get used to everybody – and know everybody at Princeton, and through the interviews and podcasting we've done during the course of the year, it's an opportunity for you to get to know the players, get to know their stories. So you need to spend a lot of time on that, obviously. But you'll find as the year goes on, you just know, you know the guys.
Becomes reflexive where you don't even think.
Yeah, you know the guys. I think it is important to explain to the audience, though, who you're going against, because I think for one reason, well, actually a couple reasons. One, you owe it to the audience to tell both sides of the story. So if, for example, if you get in a situation where the team plays really well against a team that is on paper, quote, better than them, that makes the win more impactful. You know, when Princeton played Rutgers this year, Rutgers had two lottery picks on their team. If I had just called that game and said, here's Ace Bailey and Dylan Harper, they're the two best players. Okay, good. Well, it doesn't add anything necessarily to the game, but Noah and I would reinforce, like, these are two NBA lottery picks heading up this team. There's also a Princeton transfer on this team and Zach Martini. So you want to let people know about the opponent. So I try to focus in on that. And obviously when you get to the league, you want to make sure the fans know about the league, know how good everybody is. That's the biggest question I always get as soon as I take the headset off when we get done with games at Princeton. What's going on around the league? Is Yale any good? Is Penn any good? Is it all everybody? That's all they want to talk about if they're not talking about their players. So I think you always want to let the audience know what's going on with the other team. So I've always prided myself in spending time on who the other team is. Clearly, you have to do homework on your own team, but you need to know, you need to get in the trenches and know who the other team is. I've always felt like that's important because you can always tell the story of your guys throughout the course of the season. But letting people know who the other team is, I think, is really important. When it's flipped and it's both teams that you have to worry about, you have to look at a bigger picture and look at storylines and look at what are the stakes of this game. I think that is even more prevalent when you're coming into a situation where you don't know the two teams. When you don't know the two teams, then it's a funnier situation where the fans are chirping, depending on, you know, what you allow yourself to listen to. A lot of times fans will be like, hey, you're not representing our team well enough. And I think you can get that from both sides. So you have to make sure you're doing your homework and due diligence for both teams. So there's no question. It's hard to go into games where you don't have a great breadth of knowledge on either team. That requires, I think, even more concentration and prep work.
Yeah, because I think coming from a play-by-play standpoint, the numbers can only tell you so much. Like, when you're doing a game all the time, you know what for lack of a better term, the vibes are.
Yes.
Who's up? Who's down?
Yes.
Whose numbers are maybe empty calories? Who doesn't maybe get enough credit for what they bring to the table? That is, I don't care who you are, when you're coming in one night to do Rhode Island versus Vermont, and it is almost impossible to get your arms around that kind of nuance that becomes second nature when you're doing the same team all the time. And I think that's, for me, one of the biggest challenges is trying to be authentic about it and not trying to force it and show how much you think you know.
Yes, and I think that's one of the dangers sometimes. I think it's the information age, so we want to get out as much information as possible. But I do think also, as a play-by-play announcer, you can almost overdo it in a lot of cases, because if you start reciting a lot of numbers, a lot of analytics and stuff, how much of that is the audience going to be able to retain or even understand during the course of a game? So you have to – I think the storytelling aspect of it is so vital. I don't, you know, storytelling, it sounds like we're, you know, writing a book or, you know, doing a screenplay or something like that. But that's a part of it, you know. You have to be able to kind of lay out what the game means and everything like that. Because I think sometimes that's more important than letting somebody know Johnny Smith is shooting 30% from three. What does that mean? Has he taken a lot of shots? Like, there's so much context behind stats, too, which I think can get lost in explanation.
To that point, how much – one of the things that fascinates me is how everybody's different with how they approach – this is what I tell young broadcasters. Mm-hmm. Like, take in everything that people do and tell you that they do, but you will find what's right for you. Like, when I was younger, I would have a ton of numbers, and this person's shooting this, and I would take everything out of the game notes and have it ready – and just as you do games for me, I realized 90% of this stuff, it's not that I'm not even getting to it. I don't even think to go to it just because the game takes over the drama of what's unfolding in front of you. When it comes to your prep, are you putting a lot of numbers? Are you just kind of getting the basics and you can fish for what you need going forward? How do you approach it?
Well, I think I don't like to fish too much during the games because it can, especially when you're on TV, there's so much that's, you got to worry about the producer talking in your ear. You have to worry about copy and you have to worry about this, that, and the other. Are you giving the analyst enough time to do his thing? So I don't like to fish for numbers. So I think the radio versus the TV aspect of it makes it a little bit challenging. I have been one to not lean super heavily into numbers. I think there are some numbers that are very important. To me, I'm a meat and potatoes guy with the numbers. free throw shooting, especially in this era. That's so crucial. What's a team shooting from the field? What's a team shooting from the field in league play? I think those sayings matter. I think how guys are playing over the last 5-6 games matters. I think those kinds of things, I like to put those things in the notes. Obviously, I have, you know, points per game, all the basic stuff. I don't want to get too far in the weeds. Like, I love KenPom. I don't want to get too far in the weeds in trying to explain that on the air. Like, I like to know it for my own edification. And if there's something I can reference easily, I will. But you have to do what's right for you. I think using numbers, you have to use numbers in a way, but I think you should be using numbers when it's important and when the moment calls for it in particular. So if late in the game, you always want to talk about free throw percentage when a guy, you know, first time he comes up to the line, sure. But late in the game, you want to make sure you do that. Like I will play – one of the clips I will play for students is Game 6, 2013 NBA Finals, Spurs Heat. Mike Breen. I mean, Mike Breen's great anyways, but that's probably my favorite stretch of Mike Breen ever. He was nailing everything. Somebody goes to the line – key moment, gives a free throw percentage. Those are the things you want to do. And I think sometimes you announcers try to force jam numbers in there when they don't need to, and that kind of gets in the way of them describing the play or letting the analysts do their thing.
Something I struggled with early was when I started to realize I'm not using these numbers, and then I wouldn't put them. I'm like, am I being lazy by not doing that?
Yeah,
but then I'm like arguing, well, no, you're not being lazy because you're not using it. But you get preparation hammered into your head so much that I struggled for a couple years finding my happy medium where I was like, no, this is going to work.
Right. And for sure. And I think I started doing games at a D3 level where you just had one sheet of numbers and that's what you had. So I think I come from that school as well. From that, we didn't have a lot of numbers anyway, so we just kind of had to call the game. And then back then, the charts, they weren't as refined as they are now. Like, I used to do mine. Like, I had this little rinky-dink one sheet where it's just like I had like a box, and I would just put the number in the box, and I would put the name above the box with the year and the weight and the height. And then you'd, like, write in your notes around that. So I was doing that, and then, you know, you finally get into two deeps when you start doing football and all this stuff, and it just expands. But numbers, and also, too, it depends on the sport. Football requires a little different usage of numbers, and basketball does, than baseball. I think baseball is the one where I don't see how you don't use numbers. I mean, you have
so much downtime to tell stories or just give context to stuff that you have absolutely no chance to do in football and especially basketball.
Yes. I haven't fully bought into using exit velo nonstop on the air yet for baseball games, but there's certainly a reason why it's used a lot. It explains how hard the ball hit. It makes sense. So I think you have to find what is best for you, but you also still have to tell the story. So you have to kind of find that happy medium. So it does, to your point, I think it does take a little while to kind of figure that out. And that's why we tell students all the time, reps are so important. That's why they're important. You have to kind of find your voice.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Derek Jones in just a few minutes. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. And summer's here. That means it's time to bring the heat in a new Honda. You can head out on an unforgettable adventure. Maybe take a sporty sedan for a spin. And you can do all this while driving with confidence. Check out the Civic, Accord, or HRV. During the Honda Summer Event, contact your local Honda dealer today. See dealer for financing details. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with play-by-play man Derek Jones.
Now, in addition to all the stuff you've talked about, did I read you've also done some World Team Tennis and you did some bowling?
Yes. So World Team Tennis, I did the Philadelphia Freedoms 2019 when they were playing over at St. Joe's. With Alexandra Stevenson, who was, I believe she was number two in the world at one point. So that was a pretty unique experience. I'd never done tennis before.
What was your tennis knowledge before you got the gig?
Watched it. I mean, my dad played tennis a little bit, you know, leisurely. He still has tennis rackets up at home. So I've watched it, but And the rules for World Team Tennis are a little different. So I really was going into that kind of like flying blind. And then – so I did that in 2019. Obviously, the pandemic hit, so everything changed pretty much after that. Bowling, I just got done doing year two of the SWAC Championships for women's bowling, which is – you want to talk about a nerve-wracking experience. I can't imagine what is going through the minds of the bowlers, because we go to a gym and we call a game, you're courtside, or in some cases you're upstairs. Football, you're in a press box. Baseball, you're in a press box. Hockey, you're in a press box. Bowling, you're right there, more or less next to the bowlers. You're not talking while they're in rhythm, but you're talking about them before and right after the throw. That's a lot of pressure. And the two SWAC championships I've done, I have the utmost respect for all of those women who have performed in those tournaments, because that's really – it's not a big crowd that's there. It's, between 50 and 100 people. But it is a real nerve-wracking experience, because they're used to just kind of coming in, doing their thing. They have some supporters there. But then all of a sudden you're in Arlington, Texas, and then you have – ESPN's there covering this, and you have the crowd hooting. You have somebody on the stage who asking the fans to make more noise. It's really a kind of a unique, different experience for one of the biggest moments of your life as an athlete, and that was really great. That was a tremendous experience. I've enjoyed doing it. Again, you asked me about my tennis experience. Bowling, I've bowled. But I didn't, from a competitive standpoint, I had not called it before. So that was a really unique experience. You go back and you watch and you review and see kind of how people have gone about doing it. And you try to base it off that a little bit, but add your own spin to it.
Spin. Nicely
yes.
done. But I think that, and as someone, with you teaching young broadcasters, and this is something I say when I do career days or talk at college classes and stuff, you never know what opportunity is going to be the one that takes you. Because I think a lot of young kids would say, I don't like tennis. I would never do tennis.
Yeah.
Okay. What if that's the on-ramp and you do a good job with that? I know somebody whose onboarding was a dog show and just made contact. You never know what opportunity is going to lead to opportunity.
No question about it. And you can't be stuck in the big four silo. And I've told students this before. It's like, everybody, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but most people who are in broadcasting want to do football or basketball. So there's a long line for that. And you're not going to get a job necessarily right out of college calling Division I football. So what are you going to do? Same thing for basketball. You have to figure out ways to stay active, whether it's doing minor league baseball, whether it's doing minor league hockey, whatever it is. I think it's very important to not shut yourself off from opportunities, because I said this recently as well. Like, the other thing, not only are you doing different sports, you're meeting people. You're networking with other people who might have opportunities for you to do the sports that eventually you want to do. So there's so many people that just want to do the same sports. You have to figure out ways to stand out. And that's one of the toughest things now to do. It's just how do you stand out in this business? It's hard.
Of all the games you've done, what's your favorite? Like, when you think to your career to this point, what game or set of games is at the top?
It's funny. I sometimes, if you catch me on a particular day, I might have a different answer. But I would say clearly the Sweet 16 run for Princeton was, I think, among my favorite things ever I've called. I would have to say my favorite game, that Missouri game, the second round game where Princeton just absolutely dismantled Missouri after shooting. And I think that's the thing people forget. They beat Arizona shooting probably as woefully as they've shot the basketball in a long time, especially from three. They did not shoot well at all in that Arizona game and won. And then all of a sudden it just clicks for them in the Missouri game. And it, like, when I was calling that game early on, I don't get in the mindset of this game's over. But early on, I was like, it's over. Like, Missouri just doesn't And Missouri had good players, but they just didn't. They didn't have it in the tank that day. I would say those probably are my favorite. You may not like this answer. It's actually in both categories of favorite and least favorite. Penn-Princeton Ivy League tournament game 2017. That was the most nerve-wracking game I have called. That was a remarkable basketball game. Of course, goes overtime. Miles Stevens with the putback. That one, because I think there was a lot of trepidation from Princeton supporters going into that game. You go 14 because there was no Ivy League tournament at that point. This was the first one. And of course, for Princeton, it's at Penn. And credit Penn. They got in the Ivy League tournament and they made Princeton sweat and nearly knocked him off. And that was an incredible basketball game. But one of the reasons why I love that game so much is because in Philadelphia, the Palestra means so much to college basketball. And to have a great college basketball game in the Palestra, and to call that was remarkable.
And if I remember correctly, you mentioned Princeton 14-0. Princeton never led in regulation in that game.
Penn led wire
to wire until Princeton tied it, and then Princeton won in overtime.
It was just like I tell this story, and it's probably like one of those stories over time that just gets sensationalized. I remember like Noah during the course of these games has his headset on, and his hair was just like with each media timeout, his hair was just shooting out all over the place from like the stress levels in the game. I mean, that's one of the things we're just like, wow. This is the hardest basketball game I've ever seen. And it was tough, but it was an incredible game. I would have to give a tip of the cap, by the way, to the SoCon final I did recently, Wofford against Furman, amazing basketball game, and then the Oxford Regional for baseball. That was tremendous. So I would say those are right in there. And from the Rowan side, best game I ever did was as an analyst, actually, not play-by-play. Rowan beats Mount Union, 1999. Ends a long, I believe, 54-game winning streak for Mount Union at the time. Rowan had been dismantled by Mount Union in the previous Stag Bowl. They go to their place and win and go to the national championship game. Unfortunately, Rowan got taken apart by Pacific Lutheran in the next game. But, you know, those are some of the ones that stand out for me.
For that Sweet 16 run in 2023 for Princeton basketball, was it, I don't know if overwhelming's the word, but you are suddenly going from doing games at Leed Arena in Hanover, New Hampshire on a Friday night with maybe 1,200 people to the center of the sports media storm, not just in the for the country. Mm-hmm. Like, and you throw in all kinds of travel and logistics and moving on a dime and got to move your life around because you've got to be in this place, you know, all of a sudden. Like, is that whole kind of week of the NCAA tournament there, like, is it a blur? Do you remember it vividly, or is it just kind of all come pieced together?
I remember it vividly because during that was in between two NIT games I did. So I had come from Lynchburg, Virginia to fly out to Sacramento to cover Princeton, Arizona. So whenever you cover the NCAA tournament, I've done this now for the women's team three times, and now for the men's team, this was my second NCAA tournament with them. You have to prepare if they win. So you always bring two suits. So in the middle of this, I got a call from someone at ESPN and said, hey, can you be in Madison, Wisconsin on Sunday? I said, yeah, sure. This was before Princeton won and beat Arizona. So they beat Arizona. And then, of course, I'm like, well, I'm going to have to recycle a suit pretty quickly. So, you know, you have those kinds of things. But I think you always have to think about, like, extra things when you're in those situations. So I needed extra folders because I brought two folders with me to do two NCAA tournament games. Now I need an extra one. Like, you have to go through a lot of different scenarios. But, yeah, I remember, you know, getting into town after, you know, hopscotching from Virginia all the way to California. You end up going to shoot-arounds. And then I think with the NCAA tournament, it's you hit the nail on the head. You're the center of the college basketball world at that point. Wherever your regional is, you're the center. You see the national guys. You see Brad Nessler hopping around. I believe Brendan Haywood was the analyst with him for that regional. And then it's funny, they end up going, of course, the following week to the Sweet 16, and then Ian Eagle's there, and you're like, wow. So it comes at you pretty quickly. But I really enjoyed that whole week. It was taxing because, you know, I had to basically hop a flight after the game against Missouri. I hopped a flight from San Francisco to Chicago and then drove from Chicago to Madison. It was like a two-hour drive. So I was extremely tired for
well, and did you have a lot
that.
Of people reaching out like, hey, can you give me 10 minutes on my show? Hey, can we talk about this? Did you get a lot of that or no?
Yeah, I did. I got a few of those. I had one to this day. I don't know how this happened. So after Princeton beat Arizona, someone got a hold of my mom. And one of the producers somehow got their hands on my mom's cell phone number and called my mom and said, hey, can you put us in touch with Derek? And so I did that.
Alarming and impressive at the same time.
Yeah, that was like, what? It's like, I don't know. So I did, you know, I did a call at like, I think it was like 6 a.m. or something like that, local time out there. But the one I ended up doing where I was like, wow, this is crazy. Scott Farrell.
Okay.
Called me up. His producers got a hold of me and said, hey, do you want to come on the show? And so I had to do like the sit down with him from my hotel room, and they were doing video. So I'm like in my UC, the hotel TV and all that stuff. That was pretty crazy. So you're getting, you know, some media demands and stuff. Sometimes as a broadcaster, like that's one of the craziest things. Some of this stuff that happens to you, it's controlled by what the team does. Mm-hmm. You have nothing to do with it. And that experience I'll never forget. I mean, it was just such a crazy. And then you have to find time to prepare for the next game. And then deal with like, oh, did I make sure I brought enough of this, that, and the other? Yeah, it was a remarkable week. I will never forget that. I could probably tell you a lot of different aspects of that week. So that one has stuck with me for a long time.
Are you ever surprised when you're doing a game, regardless of the venue and the sport, of what you say? And I don't mean that from like an embarrassing standpoint. But do you ever listen back, go, wow, where'd I get that? Or man, I have no recollection of that. Because when I do a game, I'm very short term. I see it, process it, say it, and it does a lot of times it doesn't stick with me. And I just kind of move through it. And if I go back and listen to something like, oh, that's right. That's how they turned the corner on that. Or that's how that run started. And I will have no remember until it's like hammered into me. Do you remember every detail?
No. Because there's so much coming at you, and I think you're worried about the next play.
Yeah.
So I don't remember. I think because I get, you know, I don't want to say anxiety. I don't even know if that's the right word. But after games, I'm like, I'll look at the notes and say, did I say this? Mm-hmm. It's like like one thing I wanted to get across. I'm like, did I say this? And then you go back and listen. And you're like, oh, yeah, I did. So or then sometimes you're like, oh, I didn't. I said everything but the thing I needed to say. You have moments like that where it's you're trying to figure out, okay, did I do the best that I possibly could? And I'll tell you one thing. It took me a while to go back and listen to my own games because it's weird. It's not natural to go back and listen to yourself, at least when I first started doing it.
I don't like it.
Yeah. It's just like, man, I don't – especially if you say something that
– Second-guess everything.
Yeah. Yeah, you second-guess everything. Then if you say something wrong, like I've had it before where I've said something incorrectly and I just know no idea that I said that.
Yeah.
And then people are like, hey, why did you say this? Oh, I did?
Yeah.
And you go back and listen to the tape and you're like, yeah, I sure did.
Yeah.
So you have moments like that where you're like, man. And it's a bad feeling, but I think sometimes you do have to – you almost have to approach it a little bit in the way of an athlete and just have like a short memory and just go on to the next thing. But – there's so much worrying about the next thing that I try not to. If I'm repeatedly harping on a storyline, like I'll remember that, but I think sometimes it's hard to remember and just get back into the weeds on every single thing you said during the course of a game.
When you're doing specifically the ESPN stuff, and I would imagine you have to work with a lot of different people from a commentator standpoint.
Right.
How difficult is that? Or I shouldn't say how difficult. How long does it take you to find your rhythm as far as chemistry with different partners?
I think it is a challenge. You know, they have made it a little bit more of a process where they're trying to put people together a little bit more on a consistent basis to have you work with the same, because that makes a lot of sense. You know, that's how typically it works. I remember for a few years I was working with a collection of people. I've worked a lot with Perry Clark. Ironically, I have not worked a lot with Noah. Noah and I have done a handful of ESPN games together, but not as many as you might think. so I've worked with him, but one of the things that I had to teach myself right away was Noah is different from Corey Alexander. Corey Alexander is different than John Williams. John Williams is different than Deb Antonelli. So they all have their different styles that you have to try to find a way to blend into. And I think a lot of it, too, depends on the situation. When I worked with Corey Alexander, I know that Corey knows ACC basketball like the back of his hand. I don't need to do anything to over-explain anything to fans. So I know he can do his thing if he and I were on an ACC game. If I'm working with Randolph Childress, kind of the same. He played in the ACC. I don't need to do a ton of stuff to do. So it just depends on who you're with and how new they are in the business. There's some people I've worked with who, you know, they haven't been in the business long. So you have to kind of guide them a little bit more. So I think every analyst is different from as far as how their knowledge is of the game and how they explain that. So that's one of the unique challenges I think that has been presented to me over the years, is just kind of working with people who are kind of trying to find their way in the broadcasting field. I worked with Sidney Johnson when he was first getting into the business. So Sidney and I did a handful of games together. And that's another, you know, you're trying to figure out what's his comfort level, what does he feel comfortable explaining, how do you lead him to it? So for some people, you don't have to do that. For others who are new to it, you might have to do that.
Kind of piggybacking on that concept, then when you're doing radio and TV, how does it differ for you? Because for my money, radio is a play-by-play man's game, whereas TV is really the commentator's game. And on TV, from a play-by-play standpoint, your job is to mostly, I think, set up the analyst to, you know, get into their sweet spot.
Absolutely. That's absolutely the difference. Play-by-play for radio, it's huge because you have to be super descriptive, time and score, color of the jerseys. All those things have to go into it, and you have to find a way to get your analyst involved, but at the end of the day, you still have to explain what's going on. TV, you know, to be honest, the analyst is a star. So I think I've heard this used before in describing play-by-play announcers. The play-by-play announcer is a point guard, and the job of the point guard is to feed the post or feed the shooter. And that's what you're trying to do with the analyst. You're trying to set them up in a way that they can succeed. So you can say, hey, what did you see there? This team's struggling shooting the basketball right now. Why? So you want to try to, I think from a TV perspective, I've always felt like my role is to, you know, you don't have to do as much description. You don't have to over-describe things because people can see it. Situation, context, I think is important, but also trying to help out your analysts so they can do their job. So you're trying to set them up. So coming out of a timeout, I'll ask Noah Savage, Noah, tell us what you think James Jones will come up with here with 5 seconds left. What do you think Coach Henderson's going to do to combat that? Same thing with anybody else. So on TV. So you're trying to find ways to help the analysts shine. And I think that's not easy to do because I think a lot of times, especially when you're younger, I think a lot of people go on the air, you almost feel like you're trying to audition for other jobs. And I think sometimes that's not a great approach to have sometimes, because when you do that, I think you do a disservice to yourself and to who you're working with.
How long did it take you as a broadcaster to get comfortable with the idea of not saying anything? I know I, early on, and maybe even to this day, I feel like you have to fill the time and say something. And there are sometimes, even on radio, just let it breathe for a couple seconds. Like, but that is so, it goes against everything you think in broadcasting. Is it something you were immediately comfortable with? Was it something you had to develop? Do you agree with me?
I do think you have to let things breathe, 100%. The pictures sometimes tell the story more so than me bumbling and talking and talking and talking about some game-saving play that somebody just made. I think you can do things to point out how impressive something is or was. But if someone just hit a game-winning shot and you do your whatever your call is, I think you got to let the pictures kind of tell the story. So I think that's always huge because some of these places you go to, you don't need to do a lot. The fans and how they react, that's better than anything sometimes you can say on the air. So there are some times where I think you can get in the mindset of overdoing it and over-explaining it. It took me a little while because I work with a producer early on, Frank LaSquadro, who he had to like deprogram me out of radio, the radio mindset when calling games. So he was one of the people who first helped me when I was working with him when he was working at Princeton producing games at first. But you have to get the mindset of, hey, let what people are seeing, let that dictate sometimes more so than you describing and describing and describing. It takes a little while for people to do. And now students, when I was first coming through, I just did radio. So I didn't really have TV experience much, so I had to kind of learn it. Now students are diving in and out of radio and TV, which is a little tricky.
From the teaching perspective of the work you do at Rowan, how different is the next generation of broadcasters? Because they have taken in a completely different world, I think, of sports media than you and I did growing up 25, 30 years ago. Is it palpable, the difference in the upcoming students?
Yes. I think there's some, not everybody, but there's some that want instant gratification for A, how they did, or, you know, how do I get myself over in the course of a broadcast? How can I become a thing during the course of a broadcast? And it's like, I don't think you should go into a broadcast with that mindset of, I want to be a star. I think that's one of the problems now, is that we're so used to this era of turn on TV. Here are people telling you their opinions on sports. And I think we've gotten more – that culture, I think, is being blended in to play-by-play, if that makes sense. And I think the danger of that is I think people now are not watching games as much. The way that you and I may have watched games when we were growing up. I don't fully know how much students now know the ins and outs of games. You hear the kids say, oh, you don't know ball or something like that. I'm like, do you? It's just – one of the things I've always tried to do, like, you just sit down and watch a game. Try not to get, because sometimes people ask me, like, do you listen for the announcers? I mean, now that I'm doing it, yeah. I mean, it's hard to ignore, but for a long time, I just watched the game. I wasn't worried about what some announcers were saying. I didn't worry about it all the time. Like, if it was like Al Michaels or Pat Summerall, yeah, I was like, because I wanted to get in the business, I would mentally take notes. But sometimes you're just watching a game to watch it. I don't know that students do that as much, and I think that helps you call games. You just sit down and watch basketball. I think that's football, whatever the sport is that you want to get into. I don't think students do that. I don't think there's a love affair with sports the way there used to be, just from the perspective of watching the games, learning the games. Now it's just so much clip, 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 clip. That's how they're learning. So I was just telling somebody about this a couple weeks ago. Fans now have access to NFL game tape, coaches, all 22 coaches tape. They're going on Twitter and breaking plays down. That blows my mind. Not that they can't do it, but that's how people are in some cases trying to learn the game. I don't know. I just think we have lost the art of watching the game and being able to teach it to somebody and explain it to somebody. That's one of the big things. I think you have to recognize early on when you're covering a team, it's not about you. The audience, especially in college, normally it's friends and family. They want to hear about the friends and their family. And if you're getting in the way of that, they're not going to like it. So I think that's you. I think students sometimes, they have that I need to go viral mindset, and that's not the right mindset to have.
And it's tough because everything in our society points you in that direction.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
And that it's not hard to see how we've gotten to that point.
Yeah. I mean, social media. I'm like, I have TikTok. Like, I'm on TikTok doing, you know, things. And that's not something I would have thought I'd be doing like 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But that's where we are now, where you have to try to find ways to, you know, get your name out there and things like that. So it's just a different mindset altogether. But I think with the students, I think sometimes you just forget like the basics. You still have to do that.
My final question for you, is there a bucket list thing that you want to call that you continue to pursue and is at the top of the list of something, a box you want to check?
I would love to do an NBA game. Well, obviously, if you're doing an NBA game, you're doing NBA games at that point. I would love to do that. I would love to do college football, certainly at the Division I level, obviously. And, you know, long term, and I would love to do NFL long term. I think that would be great, but that's, you know, it's, we'll see. But yeah, those, I would say those would be kind of the bucket list things I would like to do. The one thing I would like to do, non-broadcasting, I would love to go to Omaha. I do need to go to Omaha just to experience a College World Series in person, but that would be fun. But from a broadcasting perspective, yeah, NBA would be high up on my bucket list. And then I would have to say, you know, obviously, I love football. I mean, anything football-related, college or pros, I would love to do in any kind of capacity.
Derek Jones, thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank ESPN and Princeton men's basketball play-by-play voice Derek Jones for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me there as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Escape the heat to True North convenience stores and get any size True Oasis fountain drink for 89 cents with True Rewards. Cool that thirst with any of your favorite Pepsi fountain drinks for 89 cents. As a free True Rewards member, pick the perfect size for you. No matter if you're craving a big drink or a small sip, it's just 89 cents. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Dollar Shave Club delivers premium razors without premium prices. Get close, comfortable six-blade shaves, swift rinse and four blades for thicker hair, and translucent shave butter for precision. Visit dollarshaveclub.com/homerun. Use promo code HOMERUN for 20% off.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.